Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, no more talk, it's time to walk. Daycare votes to strike.
But first, Vietnam vets demand end to Iraqi war and decent benefits for all vets. And we're very pleased to have with us Barry Romo, who is the National Coordinator of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Welcome to WBAI in New York.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
The reality is we don't really treat our veterans very well, do we?
No, absolutely not. And the Bush administration plans for the future is absolutely horrendous. I mean, its master plan will cut space by 43% and reduce the cost of maintaining that space from $3.4 billion to $750 million over a 16-year period. Now, you have that at a time when you're sending 125,000 young men and women overseas in a never-ending war that are going to need...
You mean the hospital space, the healthcare space.
Hospital space, that's mm-hmm. right. I'm sorry. And meanwhile, you're sending people back for a second tour, and if George Bush is reelected for a third tour, the space shouldn't be closed. They should be expanding. In New York, of course, they're closing down Manhattan, but they're saying they're merging it. But when you have two hospitals and one closes, I think that's called closing of a hospital. Here in Chicago, they're closing one. They're closing one in Ohio as well. And there's more facilities that are going to be closed in the future as well. So they build three facilities in the Sun Belt in the South, and they close them in New York, Ohio, and Illinois.
Barry, we hear a lot, and of course we should be hearing a lot about the deaths that have accompanied mostly the U.S. death is what we hear about this present adventure in Iraq. But there aren't too many people who are talking about the injuries of the soldiers. Do you have some kind of an idea about how many U.S. soldiers come back with injuries?
We absolutely can't find. Well, first off, we know that there's 4,327. Wounded people as of April of this year, but those are combat wounds, and we don't know the numbers of people that are being evacuated for medical problems. When you read things like Army Times and other things, you get a feeling that there really is a health problem. Everything from a rash of boils among our troops, and that's not counted when they evacuate them. We tend to think, and the military will admit, that there is non-hostile casualties. There's more non-hostile casualties than there is fatalities and wounds. And so we're dealing with approximately 5,500 hostile things and got to figure that it's a minimum of 5,500 people that are having problems with the medications that we're giving them, the lice, the boils, everything else that's going on that's going to stay with these people, and then we're not even dealing with the question of the psychological damage that's being done to these people.
Barry, before we continue to talk about the health care that is not going to be available for the returning vets of the Iraq war and occupation, give us a little bit of an understanding of your involvement in this issue. How did you begin to take up activity in Vietnam Veterans Against the War and become its national coordinator?
Well, I'm a national coordinator. We're one of those groups that doesn't have dictators, presidents, commanders.
We should tell that to the president.
Yeah, well, it is, but he wouldn't like that. That's not his faith-based initiative kind of thing. I was a good altar boy and president of the Junior Republicans in my senior year of high school, enlisted in the military and believed in the war, and got commissioned as a 19-year-old and sent to Vietnam, where I led an infantry platoon. And my nephew was sent over there as well, and we were in the same unit. And in the post-Tet Offensive, he was killed. And I came home, and I was a company commander at 20. And the peace movement didn't spit on me. They did something worse. They asked me questions, and questions that I couldn't answer, and treated me with a whole lot more respect than the American Legion and the VFW did. And when I could finally admit that I had killed people for the wrong reasons and that the men under me had died for the wrong reasons and lost their limbs and wounded, I joined the peace movement and worked a little bit in civil rights, a little bit with active duty GIs, and then I came across Vietnam Vets Against the War in 1971, and haven't left it since. It's the only organization besides the unions when I work, because we're all volunteers here. I work the post office and threw my medals away and testified at the Winter Soldier investigation and went back to Vietnam in 1972. I was there during the Christmas bombing when Nixon broke his word and sneak attacked North Vietnam. I lived under that. And been to Colombia, the Philippines, a number of other places to document violations by the United States overseas.
You know, Barry, we're still recuperating, in a manner of speaking, from the tragedy that was Vietnam. Why do you think there's such a short institutional or historic memory that people have? I mean, clearly there are many people who were in the reserves for economic reasons, and they got sent to Iraq. But why doesn't the country as a whole have a more staunch resolve, particularly at this time after it has been so rapaciously lied to by the Bush administration about the reasons for going to war in Iraq? How do you understand and evaluate that?
I think the American public is probably the least political of almost any country where you have high school and grammar schools that teach people. I mean, we think we've got the news, or a lot of people do, because you can watch it 24 hours a day on cable or something else. But I think there's a depoliticalization that's gone on. But I'll tell you something. To me, it's amazing that the American public is where it's at only a year into the war. I mean, with Vietnam, every year they would come up with a new program, strategic hamlets and search and destroy missions and all the rest of this. And then we ended up with 4 years of Vietnamization. And the thing that's amazing to me is that they've gone through every program that we did through Vietnam, and they're already at Iraqization. And I think it has to do with the questioning that the American public does do. I don't feel bad about where we're at in the peace movement. I feel very good at the level we're at this point, and I'm surprised that it was as quick. I thought it would still take a little bit longer, especially after 9/11. So I, you know, the other thing is that so many people don't even know. I mean, I speak in high schools, and a few of the kids will have parents who are Vietnam vets, and they'll talk about it. For the most part, it's not taught. Most history classes end with World War II, not with Vietnam or even the Gulf War. But I think that there is an institutional understanding of Vietnam. I mean, George Bush said we kicked the Vietnam syndrome during the first Gulf War, and he was wrong. We're having a World War II memorial dedicated, and people aren't talking about World War II. They're talking about Vietnam and Iraq as the correlation. And I really think that's going to be with us for at least another 20 or 50 years. I think Vietnam was for us what World War II was for the United States prior to that, and it's going to be a 100 years before we're done dealing with it.
Let's talk a little bit about what Vietnam veterans against the war are doing to counter the miseducation of the American public. You had a demonstration today in Chicago, I believe. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, we had a great demonstration, despite the fact that I felt like I was back in the monsoon towards the end of it. We had a downpour that almost killed me at 56 and a half. But we had a demonstration in which we united with military families speak out. And we had Rosemary Salvitas, whose son was a helicopter pilot who from Rockford, and he died. And, well, as she said, it was homicide. He was killed, and President Bush killed him. And she led it off, and people were absolutely in tears, and followed by Rob Sierra, who is a Marine Iraqi vet just out of the service in the last less than 2 months. And he spoke out, and really people were quite moved, as he talked about, you know, being welcomed 1 minute, but then alienating the population the next, and what we were doing over there, and also talking about how the administration sent him over there without adequate Calvar vests or anything else. And so, and then we moved to Richard Tabio's, a Chicano Vietnam vet and a person who served in Honduras. And I think the question of having real people talk about what their experience is, what their pain is the thing that's going to defeat the Bush administration, because, quite frankly, none of them have anybody overseas. You would think for political reasons, at least the cute Cuban cousin or somebody else would have to join the military and get a job, you know, maybe in an officer's club where he'd be safe. But they don't even bother about that. They send off other people's children and husbands and to die for a war that none of their families have the courage to fight in. We also had a memorial to David Dellinger, who was a great friend of VVAW's and a really peace warrior that was lost to us all.
Indeed. I wanted to return to the issue of the health care benefits. Certainly with all the memorials, it would be so elementary to provide good psychological counseling, mental health services, and, of course, physical services for those who return, for those who are wounded, and for those who will invariably have diseases that will not be diagnosed or even acknowledged for too many years
right.
to come. And how does that resonate when you speak to people about the condition of the returned troops, this terrible cutback in health benefits?
You know, people are just incredibly surprised, and they want to know why they didn't hear about it on legitimate media. You know, why you can have people putting flags on graves, why we were listening to the radio on the way to work, and one person had died, and he was indigent and had no place to live. And after he died, they found out he was a vet. So they found a place to put him in the Abraham Lincoln Veterans Cemetery. Can you imagine? You don't have a place to live where you're alive, but they'll find a place to put you in the ground for while your body rots. And it's just absolutely horrendous. And people are outraged when you bring up the fact that all of these people that are so patriotic, when push comes to shove, would rather cut our benefits and our spaces and our hospitalization rather than expand it. And that's the other thing we do. We, a couple of times a year here in Chicago, but in other places, in New York City and Milwaukee and that, we work with homeless vets. We work with the VA in providing stand-down so that some of the men and women that are on the street and now even families with children can have a little respite from being out 365 days with no place to live.
What is the next step of VVAW? Where do you think we have to go in the remaining months before the election and to begin to support our troops by doing what is always necessary, and that is bringing them home rapidly?
Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, one, I think the question of staying in the street and retying. Dave Dellinger used to give this wonderful rap from the 70s and when the war was over, and he would talk about how when people first discovered that the system was wrong and that things weren't as good as they should be, that people would go like a rocket into an understanding of way the world ran. And he said that was fine for them as an individual, but when a movement becomes a rocket, you lose the connection that you had with the people. I mean, myself, after I joined the movement probably for 3 years, I couldn't have convinced myself of my newfound beliefs. And the question has to be whether you keep your ties with your neighbors and the people you work with while you maintain, I think, a political principle. And so I think the question is still going out, still winning people over, still arguing with people, still reminding people, and we're doing that. I'm speaking at I have every 10th grade class in the high school tomorrow, and I've got a couple of more high schools to do before the end of the year, and I'm just one of, you know, hundreds of VVAW people that do that and go out. I think the other thing is that we have to retain our own identity. And so we'll be holding Veteran Day's activities, which will be a week after the election in November. And if Bush is reelected, we'll know, you know, we stayed in business after Nixon got reelected. And if Kerry gets elected, we'll let him know that we didn't let Clinton off the hook because he was a Democrat. And then we expect the troops to be pulled out, and we expect decent benefits for all veterans, regardless of discharge, because that's the other thing. There's tons of people, and they aren't even bringing it up, are getting out of the service. We see Mejia go into jail for a year, but tons of other people are getting out of the service and they're giving them a bad discharge. They can never get hired at the federal government. You got working class that really cut out of a whole section of where they can work based upon that. And so we have to look at all aspects of how the GIs are going to get treated and accepted back into society.
Barry Romo, National Coordinator of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Let me ask you this. How can people contact your organization?
Well, golly gee, thank you. if you go to www.vvaw.org, you'll find probably one of the best websites on the left. At least I think so.
You can blow your horn. It's an excellent website.
It's a good website and a very good organization.
Thank you very much. Okay. Or you can call this number, which is 773-276-4189, 773-276-4189. And thanks for giving us the plug there.
Thank you.
And Barry Romo, thank you so much for joining us. And we now have with us on the line Raglan George, Executive Director of District Council 1707, asks me, no more talk. It's time to walk. Daycare votes to strike. 7,000 publicly funded daycare workers will strike beginning June 9th. Why does it have to be that way, Raglan George?
Well, it's that way because this administration and the mayor has not recognized the importance of child care in the city of New York. And he did that by not giving these workers a pay increase in almost 4 years. And that's why we're going out. It's a situation that was evident to happen because the mayor just did not want to recognize child care workers as a viable profession in the city of New York. And he's turned his back on daycare, and so they could not wait any longer. They waited 4 years, and they wouldn't go out because of the children. They didn't want to hurt the children and the parents that they serve. But they can no longer do that, and they voted to overwhelmingly to strike, and that's the only way we could get the attention of the mayor.
Looks like this mayor is following the tradition of Giuliani, who also actually this is Giuliani's contract that we're talking about back to July of 2000. So if you can very briefly make clear a very complicated situation, because we're talking about not this current year round of bargaining for most unions, but the one that preceded that your union never got.
Right. They are now negotiating a new contract with city workers. They claim we're not city workers because we're the non-for-profits in New York City. But we normally get the same trend that the other workers get in the city. So in the year 2000, 2001, when city workers got their contract, when the mayor finally reluctantly gave the increases to police, fire, District Council 37, and some of the other workers in the city, he did not give us ours. And normally, we don't just expect the city to turn up money. We go and legislate for money in Albany, in Washington, wherever we have to make sure that funding comes in for child care. That's how important it is to us. And so we've done that, and hundreds of thousands of dollars has come into the city to fund child care, and they don't know where it is.
Now, we're speaking roughly about 60,000 children's,
i.e.
60,000 families that will be affected. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, about 50 to 60,000, yes.
Now, we're also speaking about a wage that is approximately $27,000?
On an average, taking into consideration the cooks, custodians, and then right up to the master teacher in the classroom. And so on an average, it's about $27,000. The lowest paid worker gets about $20,000, $21,000, $20,000. The master teacher, if without years of service, is making about $34,000, $35,000. Now, these workers, these professional teachers, required to have the same skill level as a teacher in the public schools. Same master degrees, same certifications, and all of that. Yet and still, they're paid much less than a public school teacher. And we've been rallying and lobbying to get that level raised. But this time, we're just asking for the normal increases that they gave the rest of the city workers, and to no avail. Now, Bloomberg has put people in public office, in office in city government, in the Children's Service, Children's Family for Services. And also in the mayor's office, his deputy mayor, Walcott, we try to meet with these people, can't find them. They're missing in action. Try to get the bell. He's now resigning and saying that he can't get the mayor to do anything about child care. He never did anything. You know, these people that the mayor has surrounding him are ill-advising him, and probably not giving him the full scoop on what's going on. And so the mayor reacts to what they tell him. And they're telling him that these workers don't need an increase. And OMB, the Office of Budget and Management, is not going to give up any money. They're hanging on to the money like it's theirs, and they won't give it up. And so that's where we are right now.
Now, the money that you had lobbied for, did that go toward child care but just not toward the workers? I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars.
Some of it went towards child care. In fact, some of the programs were cut, certain percentages in order to meet the budget deficit. But all of the money did not go to. We had money for money for incentives for the workers, training and all of that, and it just went into that black hole in city government and got lost.
Now, we're speaking mostly about African-American women, Latina women, Asian women who perform these services, and it's very clear to me that families can't continue to do the work that they do in the workforce but for having access to daycare.
Yeah.
And what kind of hardships are going to evolve as a result of this impending strike, which you have been forced into?
Well, number one, the workers who live from pocket to mouth, most of them, because they don't earn a lot of money, are going to be sacrificing, a major sacrifice for them and their families, to do without that pay that they're going to lose if and when they go out on strike. The families who welfare to work recipients who were forced to go to work in order to make up the welfare that they were taking off are now not going to be able to go to work. They're going to have to stay home and take care of their children. And other working families who need subsidized child care in order to go to work are going to be without child care, so they won't be able to go to work. So that means it puts on not only the families, the professional child care worker, the families, and now the employers are going to be without their employees in order to help to run the city. So the city is going to have a major problem. And we did not want to do it, but we have no choice. It's going into the fourth year, going into another contract. They haven't even talked about what they were going to do with us in this next round of negotiations. And so we have voted to go on strike, and the workers are just fed up. They're fed up, and most of them would not go on strike because of the children and the families, but they got to a point where their families need to. Their families live on bread and water, and they need roofs over their heads. They need meat. They need the gas is going up, milk's going up, everything's going up, yet and still they don't get an increase.
And Ragland, with this strike that I know, I mean, I was there to rally like a year ago, and I could hear the tempers raising and people wanted to go on strike, and I know that you have not gone on strike, but this is a situation that is so difficult. It's been years, and you still haven't gotten the other contract. But what I want to know is, what kind of alliances have you made with the community, with other unions, if indeed you are forced to go on strike in a week?
We're reaching out. We have the city council is supporting us, and other community groups, the advocates for child care, are supporting us. CSEA, the directors of the programs, are supporting us. We have the support of the families. The parents who want to help us get this contract and have been sending letters and mail into the city is supporting us. The religious coalition is supporting us. We've got a lot, plus the rest of the labor movement is supporting us. So we have a lot of support out there. The mayor is the kind of mayor that doesn't respond to very quickly to that kind of challenge. So he's being very stubborn, and he's saying, no, I'm not giving, I'm not going to do it. And that's been his position for the last 4 years.
Ragland, you are an extraordinary union leader. You are with a local that is extremely vocal. It is very progressive. It has involved itself in and hosted so many activities of a progressive nature.
Yes.
And now it's certainly time for people to give back and to support our primarily sisters, really, but certainly sisters and brothers who look like they will be forced to the picket line. And what do we need to tell the mayor? What do we need to tell city government, particularly at a time when there is a surplus? What do we need to do for the daycare workers?
We need to reach out to the mayor and say to the mayor, it's time, you know, we could understand 9/11. We could understand the lull in between budgets. But the budgets, like you just said, we have a surplus now. It's an opportunity now to take care of these workers who sat back and gave the mayor an opportunity to fix his budget and put the city in the proper place. But now it's time to deal with them. It's time to give them the kind of incentives that they need in order to continue their most important work. We work with the most important product that we produce in New York City and in the country, and that's children. These are the children that are eventually going to take over where we leave off. But how can they do that if they're not equipped to do that, if they don't get the care that they need now? And it's important that the people that reach out to the mayor and to this administration and tell them that it's time to sit down. It's long overdue, and we can't just continue to do this.
Well, without a raise for 4 years and with 4 years of inflation, the income of daycare workers has shrunk, and we're speaking about tens of thousands of children who avail themselves of this critical service. So
right.
Make sure City Hall knows we want our sisters and brothers in Local 1707, the daycare workers, to get their increase now.
And if it does come down to a strike, I think everybody should join the lines. Let's make people feel comfortable. Let's go and join the lines. If you've got a car, honk. Let's welcome these people who are being forced to strike. This is an outrageous situation that first the Giuliani and now the Bloomberg administration has hosted on these workers. Let's support these workers if they're forced to strike.
Yes. Now, the first day of the strike, we were going to be marching across Brooklyn Bridge from 10 to 2. We're going to assemble at 10 o'clock. Then we're going to move about 1 or 2 o'clock and march across the bridge right on to City Hall. So if anybody wishes to support us in that and join us, we welcome you.
Well, indeed. We have a lot of listeners who are good bridge walkers after all these years. So we're going to see you crossing the bridge, and that's on June 9th. And
yeah,
Ragnar
9th,
George.
We'll be out 9th, 10th, and 11th. We're going to strike. So hopefully we won't have to if the mayor, you know, comes to the census and sits down and talks to us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Ragnar George, Executive Director, District Council 1707 of AFSCME. Thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with
Ken Nash
and Mimi Rosenberg.